John Rappaport with part two in the creation of a false pandemic. And I'm titling this one The Medical CIA in order to punch up a point that I made in the first episode, which is that the Centers for Disease Control has a branch called the Epidemic Intelligence Service, EIS, and has trained several thousand people since the Korean War to go out into the field to look for outbreaks and to find out what's causing them. I call them the virus hunters because that's their training, that's their bias, that's their propensity, that's what they do. And this is an insider's club that is very powerful, the EIS, the Epidemic Intelligence Service. As the CDC will tell you on their website, graduates of this program have gone on to become surgeons general, editors of medical journals, medical reporters and journalists, very important, deans of medical schools, pharmaceutical company executives, and so on and so forth. All of the elements of what I call the medical cartel are covered by the EIS, and it is a fantastic insiders club. They share the same view, they share the same models, they share the same ideas. They believe in the same kind of, quote, science. And so when one of the club would go out into the field and say, for example, we've discovered a new virus, another member of the club who happens to be, let's say, a medical reporter for a major newspaper or television news network would naturally infer that this is completely true and accurate and couldn't be otherwise because they are literally all in the same club. So when people say they're looking for insiders in a given situation and who are the insiders and so on, I'm telling you, the Epidemic Intelligence Service is a major insider. It's a major club. It links up and networks many elements of the medical cartel so that they are all on the same page. They all have the same information. They all believe in and trust in the same, quote, science, and they all report it in the same way. And so I'm going to give you an example here of how this occurred, how it was momentarily actually derailed and exposed and then was covered up again. I've talked about this before. Some of you have heard me talk about it before. It needs to be talked about many, many times because it forms a perfect precedent and history does in fact matter. So we go back to the year 2009 and the so-called swine flu epidemic, which was heralded and was produced like an ominous cloud that was gathering over the world, a giant pandemic, epidemic that was going to destroy so many, many, many lives. And there was the same kind of conversation that occurred on the fringes about, was this a bioengineered entity, this virus, H1N1, that was causing swine flu? Again, one disease, one cause. One general list of symptoms, of course, flu symptoms, but now we're talking about something completely different. Oh, yes, one disease, one cause. The model, the portrait, the sketch, the con, the trick, the piece of stage magic. It must be one disease, one cause. They sent the virus hunters out to take a look at what was happening in La Gloria, Mexico, in 2009, where some sort of an outbreak had occurred. That's how it began. It's always nice to see how it began, you see, because then you begin to look through the veil and see what's on the other side of the veil. So in La Gloria, there was a giant, giant commercial pig farm. This is not like your neighborhood pig farm. This is maybe, what, 900,000 pigs? Yeah, factory farm, as they call them. And on these giant factory farms, they have what are called, and this is not my phrase, feces lagoons, okay? Because the urine and the feces and so forth are permitted to run outside of the interior facilities, and they gather in these giant lagoons, which can be seen from outer space. And then workers spray on top of this foul, disease-causing, let's just make sure we understand that. We don't need virus hunters to come in and say, well, we want to analyze the feces lagoons to see if they might be causing disease. No. If you want to test this out, Mr. Virus Hunter, I will pour you a cup of this stuff and you drink it, and we don't need to analyze what's in it, and let's see if you get sick. Rub it on you. Dive into it. Let's see. Touch it. Perhaps, who knows? But even more than that, we have the toxic chemical foam, which is sprayed on top of that, which is toxic. So workers were getting sick. Big surprise. They called in new workers who sprayed unknown, but you can bet your bottom dollar, even more toxic chemicals on top of the feces lagoons, on top of the chemical foam, and more workers got sick. And some unknown number died. The virus hunters came in, and of course, what did they say immediately? It's a virus. Now, if you don't find that unbelievable and unconscionable and criminal, then you need to go back to the beginning of this and just keep listening to it over and over again until you begin to see the crime. It must really be a virus, you see. And so, of course, in one fell swoop, the commercial pig factory farm, that corporation is protected. Number one, they're protected from any liability that might ensue, of which there could be much. Believe me, that's number one on the list of why float this cover story. Number two is we have the opportunity to float the notion of a new epidemic. And we're always looking for that, say the virus hunters from the Epidemic Intelligence Service, the EIS, and their brethren at the CDC back in Atlanta and the World Health Organization in Geneva and other places. Are waiting to hear back from their brethren and sisters about what the finding is down in LaGuardia, because this could be a big one, folks. Let's see. And sure enough, it is. H1N1. Man, you guys are quick. Oh yeah, we found the new virus. Never saw it before, but here it is. Boom. Yep. Oh yeah, fantastic. Wow, you guys are really slick. I wonder how you did it. Not important. All that's important to know is we found it, here it is, this is what it is. Start spreading the news. Yes, we will. And so their EIS brethren at major media outlets that are the medical reporters there that are part of the same club and the editors and so forth, there's enough of these people around so that they can influence the direction of the story. It's a new epidemic. Swine flu, 2009. Okay? And so it has millions and perhaps billions of true believers who cling to the portrait that I described in great detail in part one of this, which is one disease, one cause. Not many different people having different conditions with the same generalized symptoms from many different causes, such as malnutrition, vaccine toxicity, toxic medical drug, environmental chemical, industrial pollution, poverty, crime, street drugs, what have you, whatever, fear, despondency, adding in all of these elements. I mean, no, none of that is, we don't care about any of that. All we care about is the stage magic trick. It must be one disease, one cause, and here in swine flu in 2009, they had another one going. Okay. We flash to the summer of 2009, and the CDC is trumpeting the fact that there are thousands of cases of swine flu in America. Okay? That's their job at the CDC. That's what they're supposed to do. They're supposed to report to the press, the public, the government, every week, the statistics on how many cases of a disease or epidemic there are, how many deaths. That's their mandate. That's what they're supposed to do, and they are doing it. They're saying there are thousands of cases of swine flu, except for one thing. They've stopped counting cases in America. Secretly stopped, while still reporting the number of cases. This is not something I just made up. This actually happened. Okay? So listen up, because the story gets really good now. A reporter, whom I subsequently interviewed and published her statements on this, working at CBS News, named Cheryl Atkinson, who was their star investigative reporter, had found this out, that the CDC had secretly stopped counting cases. She wanted to know why. She began to dig in and eventually discovered exactly why. Because you see, part of the process of testing and so forth and so on with all of these epidemics is that the most likely swine flu, in this case patients, test samples, tissue samples are taken, and they are sent to labs all over the country for testing. And the test results are sent back to the CDC. All part of a normal doing business every day. One problem, as Cheryl Atkinson found out, overwhelmingly these test samples were coming back from labs with the result, no sign of the swine flu virus or any other flu virus. In other words, the whole thing was a hoax, if we cut to the bottom line. While the CDC was trumpeting thousands of cases out there with the one disease, one cause picture, they had secretly stopped counting, and they stopped counting because the overwhelming percentage of these samples coming back from labs were saying, sorry, not swine flu, no swine flu virus, no flu virus of any kind. Hung by your own story, you see. And we're out there promoting, it's got to be one disease, it has nothing to do with the pig farm factory, it's a virus, it's one disease with one cause, and we're going to test for it, it's all going to be fantastic. And wait a minute, what? Most of the tests are showing that the one cause isn't even there? And yet here we are trumpeting that thousands, we're saying there are thousands of cases of swine flu in America? We must be a criminal. Yes, indeed you do. You must be. You must be. And so Atkinson at CBS proceeded to write an article about this, a serious article. Now you can bet that the people at CBS News, who, like every other major media outlet, were very busy publishing stories on the horrendous threat of the epidemic and so on and so forth, were a little leery about this story and about publishing it. So they, when she was through, they vetted it 17 different ways and ran it by their lawyers and so on and so forth. And they finally decided, okay, this was one of those times when a little light shone in. And they said, okay, we're going to run this. We're going to put it on our website. That's what we'll do. Okay. And they did. And the story was published near the end of the summer of 2009, maybe early fall. Okay. Now, the next step, and her boss at CBS said, one heck of a story. Most original story I've seen on the whole epidemic. Okay, so the next step at CBS would be to escalate and to put it on the CBS National Evening News on television, which is a much bigger deal, of course, much bigger audience, much more engagement in terms of I'm sitting here looking at the tube and accepting whatever the tube is telling me. Then there are all the CBS affiliates, television news stations around the country, and they could run this story locally. Didn't happen. They were going to do it, but they didn't do it. Instead, they shut it down. Instead, they shut the whole thing down. It became a one-off. Well, okay, we published that article on our news site, but we're not going to do anything else here. Not going to do anything else. You just caught the biggest public health agency, you know, west of the World Health Organization committing a massive crime, and you're not going to do anything else? No, we're not. We're going to shut it down completely as if it didn't happen. And then on top of that, no other major media, big time news organization in the world picks up on the Atkinson story that was published on the CBS News website and runs with it and tries to find out more and continue the investigation. Nothing. Zero. If that isn't a sign of an insider's club, I don't know what is. Because these hounds are always looking for big stories, but not this one. No, 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 no. This one is out of bounds. This is a hell of a thing that I'm talking about here. Now, there's one more element here, which I came across. This was an article published at WebMD, which I've cited in my articles several times, that came along several weeks, maybe a month after Atkinson's article was published at CBS News. And this was kind of a retrospective thing where the CDC was sort of saying, well, things are calming down now with swine flu, and we're sort of looking back and assessing what really happened. And in that article, in fact, it was part of the headline, the CDC estimated that in the U.S., at its peak, there were 22 million cases of swine flu. 22 million. In other words, if you tell one lie and you're in trouble, then just multiply that lie by a billion and tell that one. That's the obvious strategy there. So we have a history and precedent of this kind of lying on such a magnified scale. And we also have, as I've just described to you in this sordid tale, an instance where the picture, the stage trick of one disease, one cause broke down. It actually broke down in full view. And if people had bothered to look into it, they would have gone back to the source in La Gloria, Mexico, and they would have seen the giant pig farm. They would have understood what really happened. They would have seen that the whole purported discovery of the virus operated as a fantastic cover story to protect corporate interests in pig farming commercially, and so forth and so on, but that never happened. Not from big time media, not from the insiders club at the Epidemic Intelligence Service. Now, something similar happened with the Zika so-called epidemic in 2015-16 that started in Brazil. That was supposedly a virus that was infecting many people, but pregnant women in particular was the concern, because then it was suddenly said that these mothers would give birth to babies with smaller heads and brain damage, which is called microcephaly. That's the medical name. And this aroused tremendous alarm throughout the world, promoted heavily by the World Health Organization and the CDC. Here we go again. This is another one. Pregnant women in certain countries where we see a prevalence of the Zika virus are being warned not to get pregnant. It's a kind of a lockdown, if you will, without being physically constrained in an apartment. I mean, if you remember, the hysteria was rampant. In certain countries in Latin America where abortion was not permitted, there were covertly, just to show you how far this went, people who had boats that for a price would take women, pregnant women, out beyond the 3-mile limit and perform abortions out there. Because these women were so terrified that their babies were going to be born with smaller heads and brain damage because of the scare hysteria of the Zika virus. If you want to just get kind of a flavor of the crime that I'm talking about. But there was a problem in Brazil because the researchers in Brazil who had started to say, yes, look, we found a whole new thing here, the virus, they were facing a problem. Number one, the Zika virus had been known since 1947. It was known all over the world, and it never had caused any harm to speak of, and certainly not of that nature. Number two, the researchers admitted before they were shut down that they were only finding this Zika virus in 10 to 15% of the women that they were testing, who had apparently given birth to babies with microcephaly. You see, that was the procedure that the researcher was using to find the cause, the one cause, again, the fallacy of this suddenly emerging, really, was it really suddenly emerging, condition called microcephaly in Brazil. Now, since they could only find it in 10 to 15% of the women, medically speaking, humanly speaking, in every sense of speaking, they had not found any cause, or the cause, certainly not, of this condition. And in a half-sane world, they would have said, well, that didn't work. We have to go back to the drawing board and see what else we can find out about microcephaly, which I or you or any casual person could have told them in 10 minutes by just looking at medical literature, where you will find the fact that any serious insult or injury to a pregnant woman during pregnancy can cause microcephaly in the child. So again, the fake story, the fake model of one disease, it must be the virus, it must be one thing caused by one thing, is exposed as a fraud. When in true fashion, you would have to look for multiple reasons why you have people getting sick in different places. So that's history, that's precedent, that's fake epidemic, that's fake promotion, that's the EIS, Epidemic Intelligence Service Insider Club, trying to pump up the hysteria about a new epidemic. That is feeding into the addiction that people have for finding out the one reason for the one effect that they are sold as a bill of goods every day of their lives in some way or another. That there must be a single cause for a single phenomenon, when it turns out that the phenomenon is not singular and neither is the cause. And that is the case with the so-called COVID-19 epidemic, as I described in episode 1. And if you will carefully see, and look at what's happened in the state of Washington in a nursing home in Australia, where the trumpeted initial cases were all extremely old and had prior serious medical conditions. If you will look at the statistics, the gigantic number of what are called flu cases every year in Italy prior to any of this that's happening now, and the death numbers that dwarf what is now being reported out of Italy that supposedly resulted in locking down the whole country, you begin to see the absurdity of this whole thing and how easy it is, if you have enough promotion, enough insider agreement, to create the illusion of a pandemic, which is false, because a pandemic means you're looking at a single cause of a singular phenomenon. Because if you admit that you aren't, the whole thing falls apart. Now you have to go to each place where disease and illness is happening on a significant scale and find out what exactly is going on there and try to heal it and do something about it for real on the ground where it is. Not fabricate some story that's going to give an opportunity to technocrats to lock down half the planet. So let's get to the diagnostic test. That's the key, and it's called the PCR, the polymerase chain reaction test, invented by Carrie Mullis, who won a Nobel Prize for it, died not long ago. And this is the test that purports to be diagnosing. It's the most widespread test in the world, and it purports to diagnose cases of coronavirus. And that's how you would get your case numbers, which are trumpeted. Oh, we have 50 cases here, 100 just showed up there, and 600 here. And everybody gets into a panic because they believe, again, it's all one thing and it's all one cause. And the cause is spreading, and it could spread to them. So this diagnostic test fails in several ways. First of all, and I have quoted the official sources on this, like the World Health Organization, the CDC, manufacturer of PCR test kits, the FDA, in their own literature, where they make certain admissions that you can see if you read closely. The test result may not show the definite cause of disease. That's almost an exact quote from one of these reports, CDC, World Health Organization. What? A positive test that would indicate the presence of the COVID-19 virus may not indicate the actual cause of disease? Oh, wait a minute. Second, the test can show that a person has the COVID-19 virus, but it's actually a false result called a false positive, because the test is unfortunately reacting to the presence of a large number of other irrelevant bacteria and viruses that mean nothing and have nothing to do with anything, including other viruses from the family called coronavirus that cause nothing more than a cold. Oh, wow. Well, then you get a lot of people that are told they're infected, they have the virus, the epidemic virus, and it's a false positive. That's right. Because the test is reacting on the basis of other irrelevant germs. But that's not disclosed or understood, but it's admitted in the literature. And third, and perhaps most important when you really look at it, I quoted a simple word from a manufacturer of the test kits who said that the application of the test is what's called qualitative. That is to say, because it is basically a test that amplifies a huge number of times a very tiny piece of tissue from a patient to the point where it can be enlarged so that it could be studied, the test does not say anything about how much of a given virus is in the patient's body. It does not say anything quantitative about the amount of virus. And why is that important? Because in order to even begin talking about a virus causing actual illness in a person in the real world, not in a lab, you know, not with machines and statistics and reagents, and but in the real world where people live and they are healthy or they're sick, in order to even begin talking about illness in the real world in people, you need to be able to show that there are millions and millions and millions and millions of a particular virus actively replicating in their bodies. And the test is not able to determine that. Therefore, the test cannot say anything about whether a person is sick or is going to get sick. And that is the gold standard test that is now being trumpeted and promoted as the test to use around the world for diagnosing the coronavirus, which is sort of like saying, we have a compass on the ship. This is how we navigate. We don't know anything else except how to look at the compass. We don't understand the stars. We don't know anything about the tides or whatever. And we just look at the compass. Now, the only problem is that a lot of times when the compass says north, it actually means south. We don't know when, but we just know it happens a lot. And the same with west and east. But, you know, this is what we've got, the compass. And so it's a good compass. We like it and we use it and we hope that we arrive where we're going. That's about what we're looking at here. Now, of course, the proponents of the test, the molecular biologists and the virologists, who are quite sure that this is a fantastic test. And, oh, you must be mistaken. We've been using this test for years, and it's quite incredible, and it's standard, and it's, you know, blah, blah, blah. And it can, in fact, they say, detect the quantity of virus that is present in the body. No problem. We can do that now. We do it routinely every day. This is what they say. And there has been, under the surface, you might say, a debate of some sort and quality going on about this question. And so, because I was getting sick and tired of trying to argue in technical terms when the argument is not really technical, I proposed a test of the test, a very sensible vetting procedure for the PCR test. And as soon as I worked this out, I saw that it should have been done, in fact, this vetting, decades and decades ago when the test was first introduced as a quantitative detection device. But it never was. This test was never vetted properly for accuracy. And here is the vetting process in the real world. You would take 500, 700 patients, humans, people, okay? Real people. And technicians would remove just tiny, tiny samples from each person, tissue samples. those tissue samples would be correctly stored and immediately sent to a laboratory where the PCR technicians are working, and the PCR technicians would never know who these 500 people are. They'd never meet them. They're just given the samples, and they're told, okay, now what we want you to do with the 500 samples, all very simple, mind you, just follow along here, is we want you to say, which virus do you find in each case, and how much do you find in each case? Because you say you can do that. Okay? Okay. And that's what they do. And then when they're all finished, you go back to these folks in the lab and you say, all right, boys, now, I want you by the numbers to tell me which patients have a great deal, like a huge amount of virus in their bodies. I say, oh, that's easy. Number 6, number 7, number 34, number 69, number 82, number 107, and, you know, and they list those patients. Okay? Now, what should be the result? When you actually look at those humans, they should indeed be quite sick. Because they have, according to the test anyway, huge amounts of virus circulating in their bodies. Let's see. Let's actually see in the world, not in the lab. Are these people that have been picked out by the testers actually sick? Are they running marathons? Now, that's what you would call a vetting process for the test. It's never been done in that way. They'll give you anecdotal instances and so forth. But these people who are wedded to the idea of double-blind control tests and all of that have never done anything of the like that I'm describing here in order to vet the accuracy of the test. And conversely, we could go the opposite way. Tell us the people that you've tested samples from who have very, 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 very little virus in their bodies. Let's see which numbers those are. Patients. Okay, let's look at those people. And let's see if they're all healthy or if they're all sick or some of them are sick and some of them are healthy. You know? Because that would tell us something, too, about the accuracy of the test. So there is a test on the loose that has never been vetted properly, that is called the gold standard, that is being used in this so-called epidemic, pandemic, to decide who is a case number, who is infected, who is a carrier, who is got the virus, when the test can react on factors that have nothing to do with the virus, when the test cannot quantify how much virus is in a person and therefore cannot say whether that person is sick or is going to get sick. When the people at the major public health agencies admit that the results of the test may not indicate the definite cause of disease. And yet one more fascinating tidbit that I found in official literature that said basically that the test may be able to detect virus when the patient has an acute infection, may be able to when the patient has an acute infection, meaning lots of virus actively replicating, maybe then the test can find the virus. But yet, as you'll notice, the calls are going out for everybody to get tested now. And that means huge, gigantic numbers of people who have no symptoms at all, who certainly have no acute infections, will be tested. When the test, when the official sources admit that the test is not really capable of finding a virus in people who don't have acute infections. It's a massive fraud that we're looking at. And the results can certainly be manipulated in order to announce rising case numbers, as they are. This is happening. You test more and more people, and you're going to get more and more false positives, and you're going to announce more and more cases, and that's going to justify longer and longer lockdowns and more economic devastation and damage and destruction. And yet, it's all based on this fake idea that is being promoted that this must be one disease with one cause. And as I've described, it is not. That is a false picture. Okay. Think about these things, and I will see you soon next time for episode 3 in the creation of a false pandemic. This is John Rappaport. Thanks to the Solari Report and Catherine Austin Fitz for space, time, technology, and help being able to present this to you. And my articles are at nomorefakenews.com. See you next time.